Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the latest of our Directors' Dialogues, and I'm delighted to welcome Stephen Green, who's still Chief Executive, just for a week or two.
Another week.
For another week of HSBC before stepping up to the Chair, which he will, when he takes over from John Bond at the AGM, presumably, next week. Stephen's career started at Lancing, went to Oxford, reading modern languages first, but then switched to PPE, then joined the Overseas Development Ministry, then got a Harkness Fellowship, and went to MIT, and then went to McKinsey, which I guess was where we first met in the early 1980s, when I was at McKinsey as well. My career, of course, was completely different. I went to Oxford to do history and modern languages, got a Harkness Fellowship and went to Stanford, went to the Foreign Office rather than the Overseas Development Ministry, and then to McKinsey. So we could not be further apart, the two of us. But Stephen left McKinsey in 83, went to HSBC, where he has been there for 23 years. But in HSBC terms, he is still a new boy, because HSBC tends to take people usually straight out of infant school, I think, and grows its own, or at least it has the reputation of doing so. Worked in various parts of the world for HSBC, and then became group treasurer in 93, or somewhere around there, and did quite a lengthy stint as group treasurer before taking over from Keith Whitson as chief executive about 3 years ago, and then this year, in total contravention of what is supposedly good corporate governance practice, where nowadays in the UK you're not supposed to go from being the chief executive to being the chairman, he is becoming the chairman of HSBC. So you are, in corporate governance terms, Stephen, a pariah.
Correct.
What do you think about this?
Well, I think that the corporate governance rules, or the combined code as it's now called, sets out a series of principles for good corporate governance, and I think it is clear what the basis for those principles are, but it does allow companies to comply or explain if they think they have a good reason to do something different. We believe that what we did was right. I mean, no comment on the individual, but the principle of the thing, and I'll come back to that. And so we went round our shareholders explaining why we were doing what we were doing, and we've gone ahead. And indeed, if the shareholders don't like it en masse, our annual general meeting is on tomorrow week, and they can turn up and vote against it. So I guess it may just not happen. No, I think it will. The point of it was, though, that this is a very large, complex company. It operates in 76 countries around the world. It has 125 million customers. It has 250,000 staff. It's an incredibly broad range of products and services. We believed that the right basis for chairmanship is for somebody who actually knows about the business in some intricacy and detail, because anybody coming in from the outside not knowing about banking in general or the complexity of international banking in particular would find it frankly very difficult to exercise chairmanship in a real sense. So we're not saying it's never the right thing to do to bring in somebody from outside, but we're certainly saying that whilst the powers that be within the institution think there's a good candidate internally, it makes sense to do it that way. So here I am.
And you, but you have presumably, in order to meet some other parts of the combined code, you have a senior independent
correct
director.
Yes. We have two deputy chairmen, one of whom is the senior independent director. That person is, in fact, the former chief executive of Chorus, formerly British Steel, and has been our senior independent for the last 5, 6, 7 years. And, of course, it is true that in this scenario, the importance of the role of senior independent is all the stronger for it. If you like, the senior independent is the real long stop in the event that something is going awry with the company and the shareholders need somebody totally independent to complain to.
Now, you mentioned that you're in this huge institution and in 76 countries, and I think with 285,000 staff. I mean, what are the limits to growth for a financial institution of your kind? Because although HSBC has been outstandingly successful for a long time, there are people who then start to say, well, just how big can you really get and seriously control an institution like that? And putting yourself sort of on the top of this pyramid must be, in a way, quite an intimidating thing.
Well, I think it's a very important question to ask, and it is one, by the way, that we ask ourselves each time an issue of a possible acquisition comes up. Is this a step change which is just a bridge too far? We ask ourselves very explicitly. I don't think it's clear at all that there's some mechanical point at which you say a company has become too big to manage. And in the banking world, it's actually a very unconcentrated world. There's no bank, if you take the global financial services scene, that's got more than 1% or 2% market share. So there's certainly not an issue of market share getting too big. And nor is this a company, big though it is, that is out on a limb in terms of sheer size. Companies like IBM, the big oil companies, these employ more people than we do. So there's no evidence, prima facie, that the size of company we are is one which is too big to manage. Having said which, it is clearly important that we have a pretty well-honed management structure, because 285,000 people, 77 countries, it's a very large business. And we actually try and do this by an approach that what was known in McKinsey as keep it simple, stupid, KISS for short. We have a very simple matrix whereby we have regions. There's a head of Asia, there's a head of Europe, there's a head of North America, and a head of South America. And there are four lines of business: corporate banking, commercial banking, personal banking, and private banking. And that's eight people, plus myself, the chief executive and the finance director, who constitute the top management team. And we try and keep that simple. And the essence of this is not about protocols of who does what to whom. It's about that lot being a group of people who know each other and trust each other and have a sense of common purpose. And so we end up very quickly talking about collegiality, collective management, and those kinds of words. And I attach a huge amount of importance to the corporate ethos that nurtures that. I think the question of how big a company is crucially related to the question of how good the teamwork or corporate collegiality is within the company. The better it is, the broader and larger the business can be.
Now, you defined your sort of four business lines: what's corporate, commercial, personal, and
private.
And private. But, I mean, how do the profits break down among those four? Because one thinks of HSBC as the big personal bank around the globe.
And in round terms, let me give you a round terms, both geographically and by line of business. In round terms, by line of business, about half the business is personal, one way or another. About a quarter is corporate, big-ticket corporates and institutions. About a quarter is commercial, which is everything from the corner store to quite large and sophisticated, but mainly domestic companies. And then there's a tiny slither for private banking, the so-called banking for the wealthy. So that's it, about a half, quarter, quarter in round terms. And geographically, we have three big markets, all of which are about the same size in profits to us: Hong Kong, the UK, and the US. And we have a handful of other ones that would be at about five, but those are about 25% each of the group. There are a handful of others that are 3%, 4%, 5%, quite varied: Mexico, France, Canada, the Middle East, China, India. And then there's a string that are much smaller, and where our presence is only quite limited.
Okay, can we go back to the shape of the group? I mean, one thing that, for those of you who've read your FT today, is rather public, where John Studzinski, whom you hired from Morgan Stanley, two, three years ago, from investment banking, is supposedly leaving the group. One, is this true, or is the FT wrong again? And secondly, what does it mean?
First, it is true. We put out a press announcement in the course of today. It was a leak, I'm afraid. It jumped our gun by 48 hours, so we ended up doing something
first
today.
First FT scoop for many years.
It was an FT scoop. Yeah. But we ended up doing something today that we had planned to do tomorrow. You heard it here first. He is leaving the group, and it is, the FT was correct. He's going to work for a private equity business. He joined the group, as you say, 3 years ago, as co-head of our corporate and institutional business, and has worked with the other co-head, who is taking over total responsibility for it, to build it up. We've been investing quite significantly. If you follow the bank at all, you would be aware of this, attracted quite a lot of comment, quite significantly in building out our investment banking services around the world. And that's what he's been spearheading, particularly on the advisory side, for the last 3 years. And I think this is timely. I think that as the business builds up, it's now got to a critical mass where it actually needs one single head to drive it forward.
I mean, one of the things that has been said about British banks in the past, and I guess HSBC, we have to count as a British bank now.
We like to count ourselves as an international bank.
An international bank. Yeah, well, you've still got a headquarters here.
We're domiciled here, and we
PLC
have
PLC written
here,
after
yes,
your name. Indeed. I think you can't really deny it.
But quoted on London, New York, Hong Kong, Bermuda, and Paris exchanges.
Okay, I'll give you that. But what people have frequently said is that British clearing banks, or banks with that sort of origin, find it very, very difficult to manage an investment banking function which really can rival the big bulge bracket firms, and that's partly a cultural issue. But when you say culture, you can read pay to some degree, because the Goldman Sachs's of this world pay extravagant sums of money which really don't fit in the somewhat more ascetic culture of HSBC, which has never paid the sort of telephone numbers to its chairman or chief executive that Goldman's and Morgan Stanley have. So is this another example of that phenomenon, that it just can't be done within a big commercial bank?
I don't think it is, but I think it's worth my spending just a minute on what it is we're trying to do. We are not trying to create another Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, another Wall Street house. What we want to do, we have a list of clients in the corporate world and in the institutional world with whom we've done business over many decades, for whom we do things like lend money at wafer-thin margins. We do their payments and cash management business. They sometimes allow us to do a bit of debt issuance business for them. And they tell us that if you want a more lucrative and long-term partnership with us, you need to have a wider range of services. And so what we've been doing, and I'd have to say it's gaining traction, is making sure we've got the more complex trading products available to them in the foreign exchange and debt capital markets area, and making sure that we've got the financial structuring expertise in our banking area, and making sure that we've got some corporate advisory expertise in the sectors relevant to them. So what we think we'll end up with, and I think we're well on the way through to getting there, is something that's very sui generis, very tailor-made to the specifics of the HSBC client base. And we absolutely didn't and don't say to ourselves, we want to be a Goldman Sachs. On the question of pay, it is plainly the case, and not only in investment banking, that different activities, different areas within banking or financial services get different compensation. There's a market there. It's also true, obviously, that different geographies get different compensation. And we're in a market, and we have to match that. I think, actually, we've got quite a long track record within the markets area of demonstrating that we can indeed do that. But it's one of the management challenges that any large company like us faces, and that inevitably you've got people on very different sorts of compensation package working within the system.
Mm. We did talk a bit about the business line. So I should say, by the way, that I will rabbit on and question Stephen for another few minutes, and then I'll throw it open to you so you can already be thinking about your questions or some of the way the...
Means you can ask the things you really want to
yes,
hear
that's
about.
Right. That's the way the rules of this party game are. That if you look at the geographies, then are there any places you wouldn't go?
Oh yes, I mean there are. I think there are some countries in the world which are off limits for, how can I put it, sort of domestic policy reasons, if that's the right. I mean there are some countries in the world which are on blacklist, various official blacklists, or where the business environment is so corrupt, or the physical environment is so dangerous that you clearly would think twice about it. Sadly, there are some countries in the world where the size of the market is just so small that it isn't worth, in commercial terms, building the business there. One of the saddest facts about the world is that we can sit as we do, talking about business strategy across the world, and we talk in depth about where's Asia going and what to do there, where is the Middle East going and what to do there, where is Latin America going and what to do there, what about Europe, what about Russia, and so forth. And there's one continent that gets relatively little mention. And I'm deeply sad about that. We have a branch in Johannesburg. It's our only presence in sub-Saharan Africa. But I hope that over the next 5 to 10 years, we will begin to increase our commitment to that continent, because you don't need me to tell you, there's a real need for well-run banking services in many of those economies.
Looking at some of the places where you are big, I mean, HSBC has been has benefited hugely from the great growth in China over the last few years, and I guess your willingness to kind of hang in there in China even during difficult periods has sort of paid off. What do you see as the future of your business in China? Because obviously the Chinese have been sort of more or less open, more or less keen on foreign financial institutions operating, go slightly backwards and forwards about what you can own and what you can't own. I mean, how do you see the strategy of a big foreign bank in China? What do you expect the opportunities to be there?
From our point of view, we see China as an enormous opportunity and challenge. It, in many senses, as a bank which grew up in Hong Kong and Shanghai, HSBC was originally the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. We opened there in 1865. In the case of Shanghai, we never closed. We're never allowed to close part of the time, but never closed. All through, it was shrunk in what it was allowed to do. It was moved out of its prestigious building on the Shanghai Bund, but it never closed. And now it's opening up again rapidly.
Not in the same building.
Not in the same building. And we have made significant investments. We have taken a minority investment in China's fifth largest bank and another minority investment in China's second largest insurance company. And we have a number of other investments, as well as growing our own network. So one way or another, we're very committed to China. And I think that what is happening in China is nothing short of the most important phenomenon of this century. One way of putting this is that China's regaining its place on the world stage. People with short memories tend to think of China as being a poor, chaotic country in the first half of the 20th century. And they forget that if you go back to around 1820 or thereabouts, China was the largest economy in the world. China has a history, a very long history, a very proud sense of its own place in world affairs, and I believe that what's happening is that China's now beginning to reclaim that. There are plenty of problems and challenges in China, but the phenomenon of the economic opening up, particularly so far of the East Coast but gradually spreading westwards, is one which simply is going to affect world political relations, world economic interrelationships, world trading patterns, because we're seeing it happen. Because in many ways it's part of our homeland, part of our hinterland, have made significant investments there. But it's not challenge free.
I mean, do you think that China can continue to grow in the way it has without some more fundamental political change?
I don't know about that. I think it's very hard to call. What is obviously true, if you compare China and India, is that that I'm quoting, I can't remember, Martin Wolf, I think. But somebody who made the obvious... No, it wasn't. It was Lord Desai, actually. The political system legitimacy in China depends on rapid economic growth much more than is true in India. Now, China's had rapid economic growth. It will be very familiar to you, but the usual benchmark is that China needs to grow at least 7% a year to create enough jobs to absorb the unemployment that's created by the rundown of the state-owned enterprises in the major cities, and probably a bit faster than that to absorb the immigration from the rural areas. And these numbers, of course, are enormous. I sometimes think that the Western media, in talking about China, imagine that the authorities in Beijing sit there with a smile quietly playing on their lips as they contemplate taking the world over. The reality is that they... see themselves as walking an uncomfortable tightrope, wanting the economy to grow as fast as possible to create the jobs, knowing that if it slows down too much, they will have problems in the rural areas. Some signs in recent years of that already happening. knowing on the other side that the faster they grow, particularly at the stage of industrialization they're at, they're creating environmental and energy challenges. It's a horrendous thing for them. And anybody who thinks it's just a nice, easy ride to take the world over for China hasn't understood the complexities of the management challenge, if I could put it in that way, of taking 1.3 billion people from a state of poverty into what is rapidly becoming a vibrant, successful, strong world economy.
So before I'll just ask one more question and then I'll throw it open to the hall, as it were. You referred to your business heads, and one of them being Latin America, which of course has been in the news this week with Hugo Chavez here, and there's quite a lot of people in this school who think about and worry about Latin America. I mean, how do you see what's going on there? Do you think that there is a serious risk of a kind of retreat into a kind of autarkic populism, if you like, that looks to be happening in Venezuela and in Bolivia, maybe shortly in Peru, where they have an unenviable choice of presidential candidate, seems to me. I mean, is this, you know, when you sit doing your strategic planning, is Latin America now become a serious worry area for you?
No, in short. I mean, our business commitment is primarily in two large countries, Brazil and Mexico. They're very different from each other, and I don't sit there worrying about the state of our investments in those two countries. I think they both have significant growth potential and pretty robust constitutional systems. Make the obvious point, neither of them was without significant challenges. If you take the overall pattern of events in Latin America, I think we're in the midst of something, and it's too soon to tell exactly how it plays out. Instinctively, I think it's unlikely that we're going to see a lurch back to the autarkic high inflation and occasionally kind of undemocratic management styles that we've seen in the 60s and 70s in Latin America. I think that's unlikely, but A, I'm not a big expert, I'd have to say, and B, we're in the thick of this now. As you say, there's a second round in Peru due, there's a Mexican election, there's a Brazilian election. We've seen Venezuela embark on a different sort of a path. It seems to me that in the case of Venezuela, there's a fair amount of rhetoric, and the substance isn't quite the same as the rhetoric all of the time. But we'll see.
You took a bath in Argentina, though.
We certainly did. Argentina was very different sort of circumstances, but Argentina was a very painful experience for us. It seems to me that the answer to the question of whether the emerging markets, which is the sort of summary question under which conversations about China, India, Turkey, and Latin America really all fall, is terribly dependent on how you think the big imbalance in the world economy that's built up in recent years unravels. There's a bull case and a bear case. The imbalance, to be clear, and I'm sure we're all aware of this, is manifested by the size of the US current account deficit, 7% of GNP, completely uncharted territory. And they can't export their way out of the problem. Exports are 10% of GNP, imports are 17% of GNP. You can't do it by growing exports. So how is this going to unravel? Does it need to unravel? Yes, I think it does need to. I can't believe that the rest of the world is going to go on ploughing surplus resources into central bank investments in US government treasuries indefinitely. So yes, I do think it has to unravel. The bull case says this happens gradually over a period of years, with the dollar being systemically weak, interestingly and importantly against the Asian countries, currencies, and not just against the euro, and with a variety of other changes taking place, the growth of domestic markets in places like China and India, a number of mechanisms like that that gradually reduce the size of the US current account deficit, almost certainly accompanied by slightly slower world growth than we've seen in the last two or three years. That's the bull case. The bear case is that the markets take fright at the size of this deficit, but there's some disruption of the flow of funds, that there's chaos in the currency markets, and general dysfunctional movements in the markets in general, and a sharp slowdown in world growth, and a sharp fall in the value of the dollar, and that will hurt us all. So we better all hope for the balanced unravelling of that deficit. And of course, the future of countries like Latin American countries very much depends on which of those two outlooks comes to pass.
Let me throw it open now, and there's a microphone will come over to you, and if you can say who you are, that'd be great. It's one on the back row there.
Mr. Green, Nicole Lee here with Dow Jones Newswires. I just wondered, the French banks are working together to ensure that they have a say if Euronext merges with another stock exchange, whether it be New York Stock Exchange or Deutsche Börse. I wonder if you could say anything about whether the British banks are concerned with stock exchange consolidation and how you think stock exchange consolidation will affect London as a financial centre.
It's an interesting question. Let me not comment on what does or doesn't happen to the other LSE in London. But I think that it would seem to me that there is there are reasons to think about how you ensure that the regulatory responsibilities of the market are carried out in the London market in the event that there were ever a change of ownership. But there's going to be stock market consolidation around the world. It is inconceivable, certainly in the European context, that there will be as many markets as there now are in 10 years' time. The separate issue, of course, is about clearing and settling. Whereas I don't think the end game is going to be one single trading market, there are clear economies of scale reasons why you would expect rationalisation of the back office of the market. Very difficult to see how all this plays out. Yep. One thing we do all know is that the cost of equity trading in the European market is way higher than it is in the American market. There's an inefficiency built into the European system that's quite significant.
Next, yeah.
Need to switch.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Green.
Nice to meet you.
I'm from China. I'm a Chinese student, and nowadays learning risk management. First of all, I should say I'm very gratitude for your kind word for the Chinese leaders, standing on their foot and speaking how difficult to manage the huge country. My question is on the corporate governance and risk management side. You talk about the great diversity of HSBC in terms of the business activity, in terms of your location, and I know that you're listed in many different countries. How you manage to strike a good balance between your huge commercial success and the good corporate governance, especially raising a risk management awareness across the whole group?
Well, it's a good question, because sustained success depends on good corporate governance at one point and good risk management second point, and you've mentioned both of them. I mean, one way of putting this is that a car can drive as fast as its brakes are good. And it's our job, as we manage HSBC, to make sure that as we build business in so many different places in so many different ways, we do indeed have good risk management systems in place and an overall corporate governance. Now, corporate governance is a very general term. I take that to mean, amongst other things, that there is at the top of the company, there's a board that has the right composition and has the right information and has the right ability to probe the management and ensure that management is sticking to its strategy and to the regulatory rules and indeed to its own values. Much easier for me to say that in one simple sentence, of course, than to make sure that we continue to do that. But that's a daily responsibility or a continuing responsibility of the board of the company. And what's true at the centre of the top of HSBC Holdings PLC is then true for each of the regions and different parts of the business. We have, for example, our Asian business is all run under the legal umbrella of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation. It's a legally incorporated bank in Hong Kong, now wholly owned by HSBC Holdings PLC. That bank has its own board, which is both some management members and also some members of the local community in Hong Kong and also in other parts of Asia. Again, it's their job to be stewards of the business, to ensure that the business being developed in a way that's in conformity with the strategy and in conformity with rules and regulations and in conformity with our own standards of dealing with our customers. Again, a continuous responsibility of theirs. risk management has, of course, in the last decade or more become an increasingly sophisticated art, particularly at the traded ends of activities. You have some very sophisticated computer algorithms to control the valuation of products and to monitor open positions and all of that. And so we have, as we build up our business, some quite expensive back office investments to make in IT and in people in order to make sure we're controlling that. Risk management is also about a number of other things, about legal risk, about operational risk. Fraud is becoming an ever more sophisticated industry these days. Attacks on banks, particularly on their internet offerings, by pretty sophisticated hackers is a continuing phenomenon. It's not really a continuing, it's a rapidly increasing phenomenon, actually. And we, in common with all of our bank and market competitors, invest a lot of time and effort in making sure that the firewall's in place, making sure that double-factor authentication and all those kinds of things are put in place so that we protect our own balance sheet and those of our customers. It's a continuing priority. It makes for a complex business.
There's one, next one there, and then I've got you down here.
Hello. Well, because of its huge size, HSBC, I think, is a very important political agent within the international arena. And I wonder if HSBC have some kind of political or moral position. Because, for instance, now there are some banks which are concerned with environmental issues, and they try to avoid investment, for instance, in polluting companies or in weapon factories, for instance. And I wonder if HSBC, being as huge as it is, does it have a kind of moral or political position about investment and development and all that?
The short answer is yes, but let me preface it by saying I don't think we are a. I think you used the words at the start, a highly politically influential organisation, or some such thing. I don't think that's true. Actually, it overestimates the. It's very easy to overestimate the power, the influence of any one company certainly in the banking world. As I mentioned right at the start, there are very few markets where any one bank has such a major position as to have significant influence. But having said all of that, that's just a preface. Absolutely, it is our responsibility as a large employer and one dealing with many millions of customers in the business world, as well as over 100 million in the personal sector. It's our responsibility to show leadership on corporate and social responsibility, to use the buzzword. I hate the buzzword. I hate it even more when it's abbreviated to CSR. But to community responsibility, and in particular on the environment, which you mentioned, I think it is important for large companies to show leadership. We've sought to do this in two or three or four ways. One is concerning, first of all, our own impact on the environment. We took a decision in the middle of last year that we would go carbon neutral worldwide this year, and we have done so. We have measured fairly carefully our own carbon emissions. We've gradually put in place means to reduce the carbon emissions, and we've paid the money to buy the offsets where we're not able to do that. It must be said that it's easier for a bank to do that than for an oil company or a steel company. But nevertheless, I think it's important to show leadership. We were the first to do it, as far as we can see in any sector, and certainly in the banking sector. And then, following on from that, and here I don't claim HSBC as a leadership, but we are doing what a number of others are doing, we have signed up to a thing called the Equator Principles. You may or may not be familiar with these, and to be honest, I can't remember where they originated from, but they're a set of principles on the responsibilities of financial services institutions investing in project finance, basically, which require you to pay attention to the environmental impacts of projects you're being asked to fund. And then on top of that, and to do that, by the way, it's not just a matter of signing a few pages worth of principles. You then have to put in place some very precise procedures to make sure you adhere to them around the world, and auditing to make sure that we can tell as a group that we're complying with them around the world. So we work, in short, we work quite hard at that. A couple of other things we've done, and again, this is not unique. You can point to other banks that are also moving down this road. We've introduced sector guidelines for certain particular sectors of lending, whereby we require our clients to effectively measure up to certain internationally recognized benchmarks. It does not mean that you instantaneously cut a customer off if they're not. It does mean that you work with them to work on programs to get themselves up to those internationally recognized benchmarks. Forestry is one area where we've done this. Water is another one. And we're working on a couple of other sectors kind of as we speak. Inevitably, that means that there may be some circumstances where we have to say goodbye to a customer relationship. If after a long effort of working with a company, to say in the forestry area, they're not prepared up to come up to the International Forestry Standard, FSC, if you can't remember what it stands for, then we must part company. There are a number of cases where we have clients in that area where we're working with them to get their operations up to those standards. That seems to us to be the best way. Not to take the kind of high and mighty binary approach, if you will, but to work with our clients. And we find that in the vast, vast majority of cases, actually, I hope that's a reflection of the quality of our client base, they are willing to work with us. So this is very, very topical for us.
Well, the next one was down here, and I've got a forward to answer. Go in the second one here.
Thank you. Mr. Green, as you mentioned, China involves massive opportunity for HSBC, and you have been very active in the financial service sector in Chinese marketplace. And so far, HSBC is the single largest foreign shareholder of Bank of Communication and Ping An Insurance Group. And my question is, could you further elaborate on your growth strategy in China in respect of challenges and opportunities, as you mentioned? I.e. challenges like regulatory sort of limit on your stakeholding in these Chinese state-owned banks or financial service groups. And in terms of growth strategy, how can you achieve that? Through further stock investment or merger acquisitions or other, generic? Yeah. Thanks.
Pleasure. I think the first thing to say is I believe that our business is sustainable in any market if and only if we are making a useful contribution, and that is perceived as such by the authorities. I believe that to be the case in China. I think that our presence there is welcomed. The second point is we only do things within the context of the spirit as well as the letter of the regulations. At least that's our aspiration. So we live within the regulatory environment, which of course differs very markedly from one country to the next. In the case of China, there is a regulatory environment which limits investments at the moment and has also limited the growth of own networks, but is gradually loosening up. It's gradually allowing international participants to do more things. As we're allowed to do more things, so we do more things. We've seen the pace of regulatory opening itself increase in the last year or two. And of course, China is committed as part of its WTO entry program to opening up the financial services market by the end of this year to the branch networks of foreign banks, and we will be seeking to build on that. But all of the time, we'll be doing that within the context of making sure we're good corporate citizens and that we work closely with the regulators to build the business in the way that they want to see us do it. I think there are lots of opportunities. So specifically how it works out, I don't have a rigid view, because you shouldn't be too rigid, because it's a very evolving, in some senses fluid situation as the market develops. You've got in China, as you have in probably virtually all emerging markets, a phenomenon whereby you've got quite rapid real economic growth, and the financial service sector always grows faster than the real economy itself. So it's a kind of double leverage, if you will.
Guy in the third row with specs.
yeah.
Get the microphone, because otherwise people behind can't hear it.
Hi, picking up on this point, I was wondering if you had any kind of tales from the trenches. You know, strategic investors have taken minority stakes. What is the relationship between Chinese and foreigners? Is it, to peddle cheap cliches, a clash of civilizations, or are we seeing a harmonious relationship? Or are you satisfied with the progress of change? Where are the doubts?
Well, I think again, if we're talking about China, I think we're very delighted with the way it's going. We work. This gentleman here mentioned the two main investments we have: the Bank of Communications, which is China's fifth largest bank, and Ping An, which is China's second largest life company. Our relationship with the Bank of Communications is particularly close. We have an agreement with them, which has got a number of areas of expertise they want from us, and which we're providing by means of seconding people, by means of training programs, by means of exchanges of people, systems investments. There's a joint venture in one particular area, credit cards. So there's a variety of things happening. And do I think that's a clash of civilizations? Absolutely not. I think this is a very good partnership of people who are who've got experience of different sorts of banking working together to try and make the business better. Clearly, in it, and it's quite a large bank, but Bank of Communications has 2,400 branches across the face of China, and it's going through a pace of rapid change because the whole of the Chinese market is. So they have an immense challenge, management challenge of training, development, all kinds of things, and we're working with them. But I think it's a lot of hard work going on both sides, but I think very rewarding and certainly well appreciated.
A woman that just second row.
Thank you. My question is specifically about your private banking business. Well,
Private banking.
As you just mentioned, you basically got all the, you see the emerging markets, like you just mentioned China, but also, especially, you got, like in China, got the niche market of those ultra wealthy people, but you also see, on the other hand, you still got, huge competitions between HSBC and other banks as well. So I'm just wondering, especially in attracting those, clients, ultra wealthy people, just wondering how you see this competition between HSBC and other banks.
Well, I think that actually any market we're involved in anywhere, whether it's a market defined by geography or by kind of business, there's plenty of competition. One of the golden rules about banking is that it's a highly competitive industry, and whether you're talking about mature markets like this one or emerging markets like China, India, Turkey, there's furious competition both from international players and also from highly respected domestic businesses. And what's true in general is true of private banking in particular. There are two very large Swiss competitors in the private banking world. I mean, they are the two, by some margin, the two biggest in the world in international private banking. There's Citigroup, there's ourselves. We're the next biggest after the two Swiss in that particular business. Then comes Citigroup. And Deutsche Bank and a few others. And yeah, it's competitive. The important thing, a few points. One is we make it a house policy to take clients that pass some pretty demanding client quality tests, if I can use that phrase, tests about origins of money, etc. Know your client procedures are extremely important to us. And there are all sorts of clients around the world in different markets with whom we will not do business. We don't want to put our reputation at risk with our private banking business. The second point is we won't do business that's illegal. And so we make sure, or we seek to make sure, that we conduct our private banking business, as we seek to make sure with all our other business, in a way that enhances our reputation rather than puts it at risk. And one of the ways I like to illustrate that to my colleagues is this. We have a brand, HSBC, with a logo, and there are international brand consultants that tell you how widely recognised your brand is and what it's worth. And there's in particular an American company called Interbrand, which values brands, and HSBC entered the top 50 in their list of brands 3 years ago at number 37, and then we went to 33, and this last one went to 29, and they put a brand value on that. They said our brand was worth $10.7 billion last year. Now, I haven't the slightest idea how they got to that number, and I'm not particularly interested in the absolute number. I'm more interested in the trend. But the 10.7 is quite a helpful talking device, if you will, because it enables me to say to my colleagues, there isn't one single piece of business that you'll ever do in the bank that's worth putting even 1% of that at risk. So it's a helpful concentrator of the mind. You know, we seek to represent we set out our stall as doing high quality business. We better not put that at risk by doing something stupid with an inappropriate client, or doing something that's unfair to the client, or doing something that's breaking a regulation. Now, that's our stall. We set it out. We deliberately do that. We deliberately go public externally and internally with that. And of course, it's if you like, leading with your chin, because you can never be completely sure you're going to live by that successfully day by day. But we feel that's the right thing to do, and then to work when we find ourselves falling short and repairing it. That's a long answer to a question about private banking in China. Yes, it's competitive, and yes, we think we do it reasonably.
Yeah, woman on the back row next to the woman in the dots.
Hi, thank you. My question refers back to that comment that was made earlier about the length of time that employees tend to stay with HSBC. And I'm wondering, in the fact that Mr. Davies mentioned how long people do stay with HSBC, how do you find that as a factor of the corporate ethos that drives success in the business? Do you find employee engagement to be a big factor in the success of the business?
Yes, I do. And I think the continuity of various levels of management in HSBC is of value to us. You don't want to overdo the point. We also bring fresh blood in at various different management levels. There are specific areas of expertise where we've recruited in mid-career or senior career level. Our head of group marketing came in from one of the big advertising agencies, for example. Our head of retail business in the UK came in from Dixon's. And so we need to be prepared to do that kind of thing as well. Nevertheless, to have a mainstream of people who spend significant time with the institution at all levels of management, we believe gives you a sense of continuity, an ability to have more continuing relationships with customers, and of course an ability to continue to reinforce a corporate values, which are quite explicit and regularly refreshed and reinforced. I know for an absolute fact that if you take the top management group of HSBC and compare it with some of our obvious peers in this country, you will find that the length of service is significantly longer. This isn't just a marginal difference, it's a material difference. That can't but create a different ethos, and I think it's one that we would lose at our peril.
The Dixon's brand, of course, has since disappeared, but I hope that's not a forecast for you. The guy on the third row here.
Hi. At the end of your comments with Howard, you talked about the global imbalances. One of the big variables, I think, which is an unknown, is inflation, either directly or indirectly, as to how that affects that global dynamic. So I'm interested in your view on global inflationary risk, maybe looking out 5 years. And my second question is, are you concerned as a banker that I think at the end of April, the Federal Reserve decided to stop publishing M2 data? So, in the context of that question.
They're awfully technical questions. I'm not an economist. We have a house economist's team. It's their job to perform any views. I think it would be fair to say about inflation that there's an air of uncertainty at the moment about where inflation goes. There are some short-term pressures on the headline numbers in a number of countries. There are fundamental trends that have been believed, at least up until recently, to be putting a damper on inflation, notably the division of labour that has resulted from globalisation, the famous fact that, that so much of the manufacturing base of places like America and Europe has got outsourced to places like China and India and elsewhere, has led to a damper on inflation. We're now seeing an offsetting fact, of course, which is the rise in commodity prices and energy prices. And the interesting thing about that is it's for the first time, certainly first time recently, demand-led rather than supply shock related. And where all this plays out in terms of inflation, is a very topical question, and I think it would be foolish for me to sit here and say, with a little crystal ball, saying I thought I knew what the answer was. I can't help feeling, having said that, I can't help feeling that the answer is in part dependent on whether my bull or my bear scenario is achieved. Under the bull scenario, I think there's a reasonable prospect that inflation will remain, continue to remain reasonably subdued, certainly by reference to what we all remember from the 70s and earlier. But under the bear scenario, it could certainly raise its ugly head. And on M2 data, that I'd kind of rather defer to my economists on that. I've seen the sort of commentary in the likes of the Financial Times and the Economist on that. I don't have a professional view on that.
So, and if you saw, there was a piece, article written the other day, actually published in a journal, so maybe you wouldn't have seen it, by Andrew Sheng, who we both know, who described this imbalance and the options as you said them, and then ended up his piece with a quote from a Woody Allen film where the character says, "Mankind is at a crossroads. One way is despair and utter hopelessness. The other route leads to total disaster. Let us hope we have the wisdom to choose correctly." And Andy, I think you were, yeah, red tie.
Mr. Green, another universal bank, Deutsche Bank, has shifted its weight heavily towards corporate investment banking over recent years. Now, you mentioned that the weight of the three business lines was 50-25-25, roughly. Where would you like to see HSBC shift that weight in the next 10 years?
Oh, I'm quite comfortable with, roughly speaking, those proportions. Deutsche Bank, interestingly, is arguably not a particularly universal bank because it is so heavily in corporate investment banking now. And its position in the German retail bank, its original banking market, its original heartland, is, I think I'm right in saying, about a 5% market share in a market which is famously difficult because overbanked and supplied to over half its share by mutuals and government-owned institutions. So they have dealt with that strategic dilemma by moving more and more into corporate and investment banking, and by the evidence, successfully so. We're different. It's much more broadly spread, for one thing. There is no single jurisdiction that accounts for more than 25% of our profits. That makes us actually close to unique amongst the large banks. And even Citigroup, which is the bank that's bigger than us, has... and a bank that's very international, yet two-thirds of its business come from New York State. So we're much more genuinely international. Sorry, I've lost the thrust of the question. Where would I see it in 10 years? Yeah, I'm comfortable with sort of where it's at. We certainly don't have a view that we want to shrink either of the two quarters and grow the half, or anything. The quarter, half thing seems fairly comfortable to me.
We've got a couple more. Yeah. Fiona, that's in a grey jacket.
Hi, Fiona Sanford from LSE Career Service. In terms of career aspirations at LSE, investment banking rules, what would you say to students to encourage them to look at other aspects of the banking industry?
Did Fiona? We had 1,000 people from this place apply to Goldman Sachs last year.
A very fine institution, is too.
Not all of them were accepting, but
I think that it depends what you like, of course. I mean, I can think of other things to do apart from investment banking, like management consulting. Presumably, that's the other 1,000 were applying
to
McKinsey.
The other 1,000, yes.
I think that I think retail banking is getting more and more interesting because of the way in which it's becoming increasingly a marketing and technology game. So if you like the sort of businesses that require very sophisticated data gathering, manipulation and management, I think there are some incredibly interesting things going on in the retail banking world. Let me give you an example. We have in the US is our main center of gravity in this. We have a kind of black box area which takes data, and America is the most developed market in this. There are something like 300 data points you can get from public information on every single citizen of the USA. There is also positive data sharing, which means that any financial relationship you can of any individual, you can find out from the data agencies. So your ability to look at the map of opportunities from the point of view of marketing, and your ability, of course, to credit control as well, is extremely sophisticated there. And we have running the people who work that data and prod it and probe it and do the algorithms on it are people who come to that business from places like Stanford and Berkeley and elsewhere with things like degrees in aeromechanical engineering and nuclear physics and PhDs in, and they are as the same kind of people who go into Google. So that's one other opportunity. Many people like private banking. It's a different sort of business from investment banking, but they like the internationality of it. They like the sophistication of the clients they're often dealing with. And then I think the unsung hero of banking is actually the commercial mid-market. The buzz I get out of going around this country and others, meeting with people who run small businesses, and often in very simple things, but sometimes not so simple, who've got all of the issues of what is it, often they're family businesses. So you get into all of the issues of business strategy, but also family strategy. One anecdote that shall be nameless, there's a German middle business company that has half the market in world lasers. It's a very sophisticated laser machine making company. Its main competitor is a Japanese company that's got most of the other half. They've been in business actually for decades, the 19th century, but it's a powerful institution since about 1960. And this has been run by one particular individual who's now in his early 70s, who's a phenomenal individual. And just meeting with this guy and talking with him about how business works, the German environment, on which he's got so many trenchant things to say, as you might not be surprised to hear. What does he do about that? This is a wholly private owned. He is 72. What does he do about the next generation? Does he go public? What happens if the children aren't interested? You know, all those kinds of issues. It's endlessly fascinating, and they're all so different from each other. So I would say the unsung hero of banking, this sort of crown jewel in the closet of banking, is actually that business banking. It's endlessly fascinating. Dealing with people who are dealing with real business, who are employing real people, and not in huge masses, but often these are people who employ 300 or 400 people, say, or less, who feel personally responsible for their fates. This is both in business terms and in human terms, absolutely not to be underestimated as an interesting way of spending your working life.
We'll take just a couple more quickly. One there, yeah, a guy with a stripy tie.
Hello there. My question, you touched briefly on community responsibility, and you spoke of Africa as a continent which has not been touched much. Would you consider looking at microcredit perhaps in Africa, or perhaps even the household model that you described earlier, as an opportunity within Africa?
I think microcredit is actually a very important modern phenomenon in many emerging markets. We do work with some microfinance organizations, not in fact in Africa, but in India, in the Philippines, in Brazil, those three notably, and beginning to in one or two other places as well. I think microfinance is interesting because it is in many senses the first rung on a ladder. It's about rural empowerment, it's about women empowerment very often. I'm sure you'll know that 80%+ of the clients of microfinance are women, often in sort of informal cooperatives in villages, and it's the first step towards them being able to articulate for themselves their own objectives, being able to have interaction with the wider world, being able to earn and save and spend. I think this is a hugely important sociological phenomenon. I think it's difficult, and therefore, that point number one. Point number two is, it's actually quite good business in many cases. One particular microfinance organization that I've got a little bit of familiarity with in India lends at, and it's definitely standard formula, they go around the villages, they lend at 25% to 30%, very small loans, you'll be familiar with it. Their operating costs, they reckon, are 10 to 12%, and their funding costs are about 10%, and their bad debt experience is almost zero. Now, that, leading a net margin of about 4 or 5%, is better business than most banking business. And so the interesting thing is, this is actually, in terms of return on capital, quite attractive business. You don't have to see this as just a philanthropic activity. The bottleneck to growing it is always actually the people. It's not funds, it's not big balance sheets, it's not even systems, though systems help. It's really actually about people with the vision and the commitment and the readiness to hire and train the people who go round the villages. I met the other day with somebody from Ghana, actually, who was talking to me about, and he's a Filipino who's working with a microfinance company in Ghana, beginning to develop microfinance there. They have, I think he told me, I maybe got this number wrong, but 20,000 clients at the moment, but he sees himself as having a long way he can go. And in India, there are, my numbers may be a bit out of date, but the Indian government benchmarks tell you there are about 80 million households below the poverty line. Of those, about 7 million, i.e., you know, just short of 10%, have so far got involved in microfinance one way or another. You think of that number and you say, on the one hand, 7 million is quite a lot, and on the other hand, it's a small share of the potential. So I think it's hugely important. What role can big banks play? I think they can play, clearly they can play a role in helping fund the microfinance entities. On the whole, they're not well placed to actually do it. We don't have a network in Indian villages. But you can provide the technical advice. As the market begins to develop a bit, there will be other products that microfinance customers want, insurance being one, for instance, where you can provide the insurance, even if it's being distributed by the microfinance vehicle. So I absolutely do think that microfinance has a very important part to play in a whole number of emerging markets, and surely in Africa.
We'll take one more from here. Yeah, and then I've got a quick final question, but we really must let
That'll
Steve
be a dangerous one.
No,
hi, Mr. Green. Could you just brief us a little bit about the HSBC's general attitude towards risk-taking in its business? Yeah.
General attitude towards risk-taking? How can I answer that? We have risk. We have an awful lot of risk on our balance sheet. Every time you make a loan, you take risk. Every time you take a market position, you take risk. Every time you process hundreds of millions of transactions we do every month, every week, you take operational risks. There's an awful lot of risk through the system. Every time you buy a business, you take a risk. Every time you hire a person, you take a risk. So we take risks in all sorts of ways. Do we take as much risks as some of our competitors? We take more risk than some and less than others. We take more in some dimensions than some do in others. We do believe in two things, or three things. One is that it behoves us to be well capitalized. We are a quite well capitalized bank. Compared with most of our peers, we have a higher tier one ratio and a richer mix of equity to non-equity in that tier one capital ratio. And we think, particularly given our franchise around the world, that's important to do. You never know, and therefore you should have plenty of capital. Secondly, we make sure that our balance sheet is not overly leveraged in terms of loans against deposits. We operate in a number of countries where there's effectively no lender of last resort, so you pay attention carefully to liquidity ratios. And thirdly, we make sure we cap our market risk at a particular proportion of our capital base. And so we have a series of parameters like that that we have pretty sophisticated management information, chunking out the position on a daily basis for some of those things and weekly basis for some of the other things, in order to make sure that the risk we undertake is what we want to undertake and not more than that.
Stephen, the last question really is just about your recruitment, because there are people here who are interested in jobs with you. What do you look for in recruits coming in, graduate level, into the institution? Do they have to promise you that they will work for you for 45 years or else you won't consider them? What are you really after to a successful recruit?
Very important question from my point of view, and certainly not that you promised to work for us 45 years. I, by the way, when I joined, signed a 2-year contract, and I thought you don't do anything for 2 years, so let's assume it's really 4 years, but then it became 6 and then 8 and then 10 and so on. No, I think in this world of ours, it's entirely reasonable for you to approach an institution like us saying, I'll start there, but I don't know where I'm going to finish. It depends on how things evolve. We recruit a lot of graduates every year, of course, in company with most big companies. We are very diverse now in where we recruit from. We recruit from 70 different universities in 50 different countries around the world now. And we go through a pretty rigorous process of all the kinds of things you may have been on the receiving end of. And by the way, we bring everybody quite shortly after they've joined the bank into our development centre, which is just north of London, in groups of 40-ish. And then I and the current chairman and one or two other of the senior management meet with them in small groups. We go up several times a year and have a dinner with them, and we'll have a kind of Q&A session about the meaning of life and the business of the bank and so on. And I have to say, there's nothing that I find more energizing. You meet with groups of people who are ready to change the world by next week, who come from, you know, in a group of 40, there are probably 20 different nationalities. It's endlessly energizing. What do we look for in people? We look for graduation with a good degree from a good background in terms of where the degree was got. We're not so interested in what the degree was in. We are a little bit interested in languages, by which I don't mean that those of us who only speak English don't have a chance, but we're really interested in people who speak Mandarin, Spanish, French, Arabic, a number of other languages that are important to us in the group. And we're interested in, and this is hard to define, but you know what I mean. We're interested in that certain something on the CV or that comes across an interview that shows somebody's got an energy, a creativity, a sense of responsibility, a willingness to take leadership, those kinds of things. Some of those come out in CVs. Some of them come out in dialogue. We like to think there's something there like that. I'm not saying anything you wouldn't hear from a number of other banks or indeed a number of other large companies in other sectors. But there's nothing more important, at the risk of stating the obvious, than our getting our graduate recruitment right. Because it is the lifeblood of the company. It is the regeneration of the business. And by the way, I think it's huge fun.
Well, it must be expensive to go to 70 universities in 50 countries. So we have a cost-saving idea for you, is that if you want Indians, Latin Americans, Chinese, even British, we have here a few, then LSE is all you need, really. Thank you very much for spending time with us this evening. It was most illuminating. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.